time to go to work.
Welcome to Remember 64, where this week we go on another wild adventure with
Junior.
Welcome to the show, everyone. My name is David Petrangelo, and this week we'll be suiting up with Indy himself for one of his many adventures with Indiana Jones and the Infernal Machine. Momentarily, I'll be joined by Matt from the Sequel Cast 2, a fellow podcast of the Tokyo Beat Podcast Network. There on that podcast, they talk about a whole whack of nerdy topics, not just games, but also movies and TV shows. Most recently, in the last several months, they've covered Who Framed Roger Rabbit, Mission Impossible films, Star Wars games, and a whole bunch of different angles of comic book properties, and a whole lot more. All right, we're going to dig into this pretty quickly here. Let's bust out the history books, everyone.
I'm learning!
We're heading back to December of 2000. Indiana Jones and the Infernal Machine is the first 3D game in the Indiana Jones gaming franchise. Its release was sandwiched between a Windows release the year prior and a Game Boy Color version that was made available in 2001 in North America. The Infernal Machine takes place in 1947, not too long after the events of the original trilogy of movies and The Last Crusade. Notably, if you do remember, these three films involve quite a few Nazis. The creator and lead on this game thought that became a little too tired by this point and set the game in the Cold War era with the enemies being Russian. But funny enough, one of the first ideas that lead Hal Barwood had was to introduce aliens into this franchise, but guess who stepped in to veto that? George Lucas himself. He said he was holding on to that very specific idea for a then unannounced fourth Indiana Jones movie. LucasArts developed the game initially, and Factor 5 was tasked with doing the N64 version of the game. Factor 5 opened up in the 1980s, beginning with games like R-Type, Super Turrican, Contra Alien Wars, Indiana Jones' Greatest Adventures, and on the Nintendo 64, they also helped create Star Wars Rogue Squadron and Battle for Naboo. The team at Factor 5 worked alongside LucasArts to port the PC version to the console over the course of 1999 and the early parts of 2000. Now, keep this in mind, around this time of the gaming industry, many ports took within a year probably to create and move over, but this one took 19 months. But that's because it wasn't a straight-up replica. There was enhanced real-time lighting, different control schemes, a camera that acted differently, particle systems, as well as adding in a lock-on targeting mechanic. On the N64 version, you can also save anywhere, but it only loads on certain checkpoints, not right in the location you saved, which is how it works on PC. One of the craziest things I found out while recording this episode with Matt was that this game was so limited in its physical availability. The North American port was exclusive, yes, exclusive to the LucasArts store. Think about this. This was in the late 90s and early 2000s. It wasn't nowadays when pretty much everything is available on a store in some way or another. And the majority of the stock was only available at Blockbuster. So if you didn't live anywhere close to one, or that Blockbuster in particular did not have a copy, well, you're kind of out of luck. Up here in Canada, where I'm recording, where I live, Blockbuster was actually not the most popular rental store at the time. It was a number of other ones that are Canadian brands. Traditional retail store copies were very limited. This decision has actually had a long-lasting effect on the game, with it being so difficult to find in the physical form. They even sell now, online at least, for over $100 for just the cartridge alone. The updated or current gen PC ports are broken in a number of ways, and even if you want to emulate it, it's nearly impossible, something we'll talk about in the chat in just a few minutes. Now, this is a whole other topic we can get into as to how things were distributed, where they were sold, how they were sold, how many copies there were. We've talked about this with a bunch of other games on Remember 64 at this point, but this one was one of the strangest ones, and yeah, it still carries over to today. And before we get to our chat, I just thought I would mention patreon.com/remember64show. This is where you can help us grow the show, do more cool, fun things. Hopefully you've joined us on some of our streams and our extra content on YouTube as well. Remember-64 on YouTube. Patreon is where we're going to start to expand things. It has changed the way it works quite a bit in the last little while, including having availability of free things as well. So it's not just going to be behind paywalls. So more things will be coming up on Patreon as well. Also, if money isn't available to you to contribute to the show, not a problem. Why don't you just give us a rating on your podcast app of choice, more specifically Apple and Spotify, which do have some pretty good rating systems that will help more people find this funky, cool, wacky Nintendo 64 podcast.
In a world of podcasts, only three men are willing.
Well, dude, what are you doing, James?
You told me to do the promo for the podcast, right? That's what we're doing.
But I mean, you know, we could actually tell people about what we are. I mean, we're the Famicast. We're a bi-weekly show. We talk about Nintendo and games in Japan. I'm Danny, and that was James. And we got another guy. Who are you again?
I'm the saboteur. I'm the henchman. I'm the interloper.
That's Ty. He is our anime trash expert. Digs around in some UFO catchers for us. Check us out.
We're in Japan. We like Nintendo most of the time.
The Famicast, only on the Tokyo Beat Network.
Jones, there you are. Got a statue for me?
Will this do?
It just might. Anything else?
According to the inscription, the tower once housed a great engine. When the Babylonians smashed the thing, four priests escaped with the parts.
Taking them where?
Not sure, except in one case. Some fellow named Ergon headed for the Heavenly Mountains. There's a crude map of Central Asia.
As always on Remember 64, it's time to bring in a guest to talk about this cool, awesome, interesting, potentially up or down type of game. Hey, we'll talk about it. We'll get to it. We got some Indiana Jones to talk about. But to join me as a fellow podcaster on the Tokyo Beat Network, Matt from the Sequel Cast 2 is here. Matt, how are you? And thanks for coming on the show.
Good. Thanks. Happy to be here. Thanks for having me on, Dave. Yeah, Nintendo 64, it's an interesting system, isn't it? Because it was like, it didn't have CDs. The other competing systems did. And it was before the online stuff was really huge. Before, you know, there's patches and DLC and all these things. It was a simpler, more innocent time.
Yeah. I think it's this generation of consoles. It's the PlayStation 1, a little bit Dreamcast. But, you know, like Dreamcast kind of introduced some internet features and things like that. But it's sort of like the awkward phase, I think, of gaming. I think that feels like what it is, whether the way things look or control or just, you know, the games that were available. It's sort of like the 64 is kind of right in the middle of that, I think. But for better or for worse, that's just how the console is. But yeah, since we're talking about it, since we got into it already, let's talk about your experience with the 64, you know, growing up. But was it something that you had day one? Is it something you got into later? What kind of games were you playing? All that kind of stuff.
Right. Yeah. So I never owned a Nintendo 64, and I know the reason why, but it's, you know, I had Nintendo, Super Nintendo. And then at the time I was really into the Final Fantasy series, and that was on PlayStation, not Nintendo 64. But I certainly had friends that had Nintendo 64. In fact, one who I guess his birthday was before Christmas or whenever the system came out. So he had the game for Shadows of the Empire on his shelf, but no console for it. He had just a box on it for, you know, 6 months or whatever the difference was.
Amazing.
Before he could get the actual system for the holidays. So, you know, I would go to my friends' houses and we'd play Shadows of the Empire. Some mainly, you know, GoldenEye, James Bond 64, Mario Kart.
Yep.
was the big one. And then maybe Mortal Kombat Trilogy. I seem to remember a lot of that one.
Yeah, that's an early one too, as well for consoles. So yeah, that'd be kind of like the one of the fighters that kind of would have kicked it off, I guess. So
right. Let's see. I did work in retail when towards the tail end of Nintendo 64, and it was a store called Media Play. I think they might have just been in the United States, but kind of like Best Buy, but they sold books and stuff. So not refrigerators, but they sold books and movies and CDs and video games. So some place to work at. And this was around Christmas time, which was a terrible time to work retail. And we had the Legend of Zelda Majora's Mask, which kept selling out. It was in, you know, pretty limited supply. And I got a phone call in, and video games wasn't my department, but I said, oh, I think we have one in. And then I got chewed out by the boss saying, like, no, you don't take a call that's not, because I worked in the DVD department. They're like, you don't take a call that's not in your department. You ruined this kid's holiday. You know, they tried, you know, they were making a big deal of it, which is whatever. But I think that one, and also like Donkey Kong 64. I later worked at Blockbuster Video. Any of the stuff that required a memory pack, kids kept renting the games and losing the memory pack.
Oh, man.
So that was a big thing.
So would the rental come with the expansion pack? I guess it kind of would have to, right? Yeah,
it would. Oh, it would. And I think it didn't require a deposit exactly, but it was still at the time where if someone wanted to rent a system, they could with a $100 deposit or something ridiculous.
Yeah.
And, or that's, you would,
you'd take it for like a weekend or a week or something.
Yes.
Or $100 or something like that. And then you could get a couple games for $3 or $4 or whatever rentals used to cost, something like that.
Right. Or was that, but I mean, this game,
I don't know,
Indiana. Yeah. This game, Indiana Jones and the Infernal Machine on N64, I think was a Blockbuster Video exclusive in the States.
Oh, wow.
Where you could only buy it at, you could rent or buy it at the store. The other title I remember like that is Clay Fighter 64 and a third or whatever it was called.
Yeah.
The director's cut version.
Yeah.
So there were some games where they had that deal. And I mean, it just was sort of strange to see what stuff came out on Nintendo 64 and what stuff didn't. And you had a lot of games that came out on, you know, PlayStation and Nintendo 64, where it had no business coming out on Nintendo 64, but they still worked out okay, like StarCraft or you know, some of the Command and Conquer, some of these things with video, right? Where they kind of the Resident Evil, I think had one of those was on Resident Evil 2, I think might have been N64.
Yeah, I played Resident Evil 2 earlier on the show, and you know, it was one of those things where I've played the game before. I played the remake, which was fantastic.
Sure.
I'm not a massive Resident Evil fan, but I was like, you know what, this is kind of like a good. Let's go back and play this game. There's no way this thing's going to work on this console. Like, there's no way. How could they possibly pull this off? And for the most part, I think they did, which is really interesting. It's amazing how, like, games like that, or even a little bit with Indiana Jones, I would say, but how much they could pack into such a small amount of memory. Like, I don't know if these companies were, like, perfecting things as they went, whether it was notes from other developers or publishers or previous experience, all this kind of stuff. But like, the further along you went into the console, you really saw that like these teams really got some experience behind them and really were able to like expand what they were able to do. And I think that's one of the pluses of this Indiana Jones game. And I think something like Resident Evil also shows that as well, because that game is, no, it's not like this massive map or anything, but there's a lot going on in Resident Evil. There always is. And it's not uncomplicated, you know. So before we played Indiana Jones, have you played it before? Had you did you have a past with it?
A little bit, yeah. I don't, you know, it wasn't it, my computer at the time couldn't run it, and I didn't have a Nintendo 64. But when good old games, GOG.com, got the Indiana Jones, got the Star Wars stuff up there fairly early, all things considered. Yeah. So I certainly picked that up for, I don't know, what was it, like $5.99, you know, $6, whatever it was, or maybe I waited on sale. But yeah, so that's when I first played it. You know, I was interested in playing it. At the same time, I was a little bit confused because a lot of the Indiana Jones games before those were like Fate of Atlantis or Last Crusade, and I played that on the computer, and they're more slower paced and you're solving puzzles. In this one, they're trying to do Tomb Raider, which makes sense. Yes. But, you know, how they go about it was surprising, I thought.
Yeah, there's aspects. And that's the same with me. Like, I hadn't played this game before. I knew of it and knew that it was even on Game Boy. I knew someone that had it on Game Boy Color, I think it was. Obviously, a slightly different game, 2D, all that kind of stuff, right? And I've played like Atlantis and Last Crusade. Last Crusade is my favorite indie movie. So I had a friend who had that on PC and I was like, oh, I have to play this. And yeah, I kind of feel, you know, it's this classic like point and click LucasArts games, like, you know, Day of the Tentacle and things like that. Like that's kind of, it's that style game, or at least most of them before this were that. So this is kind of indie Tomb Raider, I guess, in a way. And yeah, I hadn't played it before. And you're talking about how you got a copy of this. That's one of the things that we went back and forth with in messages for a little bit. So we'll sort of give people a little bit of a background that, like, getting a physical copy of this game is very expensive and difficult to do. Probably, which I didn't realize until you just told me, I didn't realize this, that it was a Blockbuster exclusive, at least for a while, if it wasn't later. So that already gives you like a limited supply of this game, or limited number of physical cartridges that would be out there. So that could be part of it. And then, you know, I attempted to play it on an emulation device, or emulate it even on my computer. I wanted to play this game. I'm in Indiana Jones fever. I watched the recent movie. You know, I love this series. I really, really love those original three. Like, they are right up there with like Star Wars and stuff with me. I absolutely love them. But there's this like known glitch and known emulation problem across the board. And it is, when I was looking up to try and figure out how to play this game properly, the game would always crash at the end of the first level, which is only like 15 minutes of gameplay. It's like nothing, right? So I did it a couple of times. I was frustrated, like, what the hell? Why can't, you know, 64 is not easy to emulate, so I understand that, but I did it like two or three times. I was like, this is nuts. I can't believe this. Luckily, there is a copy, like you got on GOG. I got a copy on Steam, and it had actually Atlantis and Last Crusade in like the same bundle.
Fun.
Yeah, so it's kind of cool. So I'm going to go back and maybe, you know, touch on those every once in a while. I got like four games for $7 or something like that. Whatever, that's fine. I should have looked at that first, honestly. So for me, my journey with this game started here. And also trying to figure out how to play this with the controls, because even a Steam version of it, I don't know if you have a similar story, but the Steam version of it has a hard time reading Xbox, PlayStation, like more modern controllers. So for a little while, I was playing this with the keyboard and keyboard only. And it was interesting because it took me back to, I would say, the late 90s, early 2000s, when a lot of games did control with just the keyboard. But then eventually I found a way and sort of through like the Steamworks stuff to play it with the 64 controller. So thankfully I was able to actually get the sort of genuine experience, I guess you could call it. Any of that ring similar to you, or?
Yeah, you know, I ended up having just to stick with the keyboard, which I do have a controller in here. I have like a PlayStation 2 controller I could have made it work with, but I just didn't feel like putting in that time. And yeah. I mean, gee, trying to do like the jumps and physics on a keyboard, I imagine on a controller it was probably challenging as well, but it's been a while since I've played they called these 3D games weirdly back then, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but you know, like a third person action game. And we've certainly come a long way in controls. And also as far as like signposting, letting players know where they're going or what they're supposed to do. Cause this first level is not that good. It just dumps you in a generic canyon in the middle of nowhere. And it's like, okay, have fun. You're probably going to jump off a few cliffs and so forth. And the designer that worked on this, Hal Barwood, also did Fate of Atlantis, but they had an Indiana Jones game planned after Fate of Atlantis that would have been an adventure game called the Iron Phoenix, where they're looking for the spear to resurrect the body of Adolf Hitler. But because these adventure games sold well in Germany, and Germany bans Nazi imagery, they, you know, that kind of put the kibosh on the game. But they did make a comic book based on what that game would have been, or elements of it.
Okay, that's where I've heard that before. It's like you said that and I go, oh yeah, that does sound familiar. But like, you know, yeah, it's true. Like, okay, so when you start this game, yeah, you're literally thrown into like this brown box sort of thing. And there's really just one way you can go, even though it looks very expansive. And sure, you could make it to other areas. There are sort of like semi-branching paths. I mean, you do end up at the same ending point, but there are some sort of like small paths that will take you on a different way to get there or whatever, at least in some of the levels. So that's kind of cool. But yeah, figuring out where you need to go sometimes, or know that you can actually climb that cliff or that ladder or that ledge is hard to tell sometimes because it all kind of looks the same. It's all kind of the same shade of beige and brown and sometimes grays or sometimes snow, you know? So, I think it starts off pretty well. Like I didn't hate the first stage since I played it a couple times. I think I got used to knowing what to do and how to make the jumps and stuff, but it's Indy just moves very clunky, and that is in design, like game design, but also the controls. And the controls are hit and miss depending on what you're doing. I think it sounds like you're kind of on the same page.
Right, it's hit and miss. Just turning him around, having him jump, it's a lot of getting momentum and using mm-hmm. the whip to swing, and the momentum of the swinging and the momentum of the swinging and when to let go. And I mean, that is part of the fun in a way, I suppose. And every Indiana Jones game does that a little differently. But it's, I do wonder how the game did when it came out as far as sales go, because it's a long time between Indiana Jones movies. Other than those first three, those are all done, you know, I think released within a decade or something. But
yeah.
It's like you have a main character who's in his 40s and it's set in the past. And, you know, I could maybe be sort of a hard sell for.
Yeah. It's tricky, right? Because Indiana Jones, you know, 10, 15 years, or at least 15 years since the Last Crusade, probably this game, right? Roughly around there. That's a different market at this point. And N64, sure, maybe there's some 30 to 50 year olds that had it for themselves, but I think the marketing wasn't there and wasn't meant, quote unquote, meant for that. So how it actually sold is a little hit and miss. It's hard to tell. I was looking that up actually a little while ago, and it doesn't seem like there's a set solid, you know, sales thing, number for it, because I think a lot of that had to do with this blockbuster thing. I think this is coming down. This blockbuster thing is just a revelation to me at this point, I got to tell you. And you were right in the heart of it, so to speak. So, I wonder who it was sort of marketed to. I guess it's kind of marketed to people that didn't have a PlayStation or also had a 64 and wanted to play something similar to Tomb Raider, but with also a recognizable character. I could see that. I guess I kind of understand that that's like an approach. How successful it was is a different story. Do you think that this felt like Indy in any way, or did it kind of just feel like another game with, you know, a guy with a brown hat and a whip, I guess.
Yeah, and a whip, of course. That's a good question. No, I think it felt enough like Indiana Jones once the story started going. It's just the movement is so stiff, and I agree it's of its time, but I think that was a more difficult pill to swallow. That it followed up on Fate of Atlantis with Sophia Hapgood is the female protagonist again, which was cool. I like that part of it. You know, the bad guys are not the Nazis again. Right. Yeah. Like that was good. I don't know the title though, and the main device, the Infernal Machine. It's like, what does that even mean? Like there's something where you have, you know, the Ark of the Covenant, or even the stones in Temple of Doom are based off of something real, sort of.
Right.
But Infernal Machine, it's a bit like the title for the last Indiana Jones movie, Dial of Destiny, mm-hmm. in which it's not quite there. Even Kingdom of the Crystal Skull sounded kind of cool.
Sounds cool. Crystal Skull sounds cool. Like that's, to me, it sounds good. Sounds cool, I wish the movie followed up on the title, but you know, hey, it is what it is.
Right, but it's like, hey, Billy, want to come to my house and play Infernal Machine? Like it's such a mouthful of a word. I wonder if they should have thought about it a bit more.
Yeah.
Because you do have these fantasy elements, and it's always there in Indiana Jones to some degree. You have the ghost coming out of the Covenant to melt the Nazis and stuff. And yet, even though it's a video game, sometimes with Indiana Jones, I find it can be a difficult pill to swallow where, mm-hmm. oh, he's facing the ice god, the fire god, whatever it is. He has to jump across all these pits. Like it feels... I hesitate to call Indiana Jones realistic, but it's a real fine line.
Yeah, I agree. I've thought about that. So when I rewatched all the movies, I think this is about 2, maybe 3 years ago, my wife had seen, I think probably just Last Crusade or I think in full, and then pieces of all the other ones. So she recognized all the movies. She knew what they were. She knew what they were about, whatever. I was like, let's just watch them. This is gonna be great. I love these movies. I'm happy to watch them all again. She's like, yep, great. Let's do it. And yeah, as I'm watching them, I go, wow, these are sort of like cartoons in a lot of ways. A lot of the action mm-hmm. scenes feel very cartoony, but are rooted in some version of reality. And the story, all the people feel real. Maybe some of them are a little bit more exaggerated. Fair enough. It's a movie. It's an action adventure. And then there's, yeah, all this like supernatural sort of stuff happening around. And they do that with Infernal Machine, but I think what you're touching on is that it goes maybe a little too far and gets a little too wacky, especially towards the end. I like Indiana Jones stories. I'm happy to like go along for the ride, but yes, like you said, it is a game, but it doesn't need to go to that extent for it to be a good game. Like, I feel like they could have, I don't know. It felt like too much. It just felt like too much. I think it's good. Until I think the last third, I kind of enjoyed it up until that last third. And when you're sort of, yeah, the gods and you have all the pieces to the Infernal Machine. And then, yeah, there's a couple twists and turns in the story and stuff. That's fine. It's very indie. It's very action adventure movie and video game. But then like actually doing it and actually like saving her and actually doing the whole thing at the end just feels awkward to me. And it didn't feel like it fit. I don't know.
Right. And especially having to save her at the end compared, you know, that it was the same character from Fate of Atlantis, where she had a much more active part in the story.
Right.
And at one point, I think towards the end of that game, she, you know, was like part Atlantean god or something, like had all these powers. Like it gets pretty strange.
I do not remember that. That's hilarious.
Okay. It gets strange towards the end there. I think you have to.
Yeah.
Make sure she doesn't get possessed, or maybe that's the bad ending or something, but it's
right
that it was following up from a computer game that was that old. At the same time, I like it's that same character, but maybe it should have been a different one.
Mm-hmm.
Come to think of it, because yeah. It'd been so much time, and it was, you were trying to do a new system with Nintendo 64. I mean, it also had a PC release, but people set up the expectations. Oh, this old game was an adventure game. This new one would be like it. And it's like, not really. It's doing a whole different thing.
Yeah. Like it's a whole new system. So it doesn't necessarily have to appeal to the exact same people sort of thing. So that's a good point. I agree.
And I don't know what it is whenever they try to do a voice for Indiana Jones, but it never works. It's, you know, they can't get Harrison Ford.
I was just going to mention the voice acting. On the plus side, it's cool that everything is voice acted. It's yes. another thing how I was saying before, how like that's something that they, you know, it's nice to have, but I think the game would have been still okay without it. Like you could have survived, I guess. A lot of games like this don't have voice acting, but everyone talks, everyone, you know, regardless of how it's delivered, regardless of how it's programmed in and timing and all those things. It's cool that everything's voice acted in the PC versions. Which I didn't realize until as I was like looking through the differences and stuff here, the PC versions, their mouths actually move to the words. That's the biggest difference as far as those cutscenes and things go. But yeah, the person who plays Indy, I think some of the things he says feels like Indy or can feel like Indy, but it's so interesting that like Harrison Ford doesn't have like the most unique voice in the world, I would say. But if you aren't Harrison Ford, it's really hard to be Harrison Ford. You know what I mean?
Right. It's a deep voice. It's kind of mumbly.
Yeah.
You know, Harrison Ford sounds like Harrison Ford, and he can also sound kind of flat sometimes, but then when someone else mm-hmm. does it, it just feels so off. It's like when someone was, it's not quite like a Schwarzenegger or a Stallone because people imitate those all the time.
Right.
And you can do cartoonish and kind of get it, but there's something,
it's,
I don't know. It's like you're trying to imitate Paul Giamatti or something, or it's like some,
yeah, just a regular dude, right?
Just like a regular guy. Yeah.
Like if someone tried to imitate us, it would be like, who, you're just, you know, Bob from down the street. Like you're just nobody. Like, you know, it's true that there is, you know, like you were saying before with some of the story element, there's a fine line with story and where things go, and there's a fine line with some of this acting.
The Tian Shan Range straddles the border between China and Kazakhstan. The name translates as Heavenly Mountains.
Kazakhstan? Last time I looked, that was Soviet territory.
Maybe I won't show the border guards my passport.
Okay, buddy, it's your funeral.
The Soviet border, and it looks well guarded.
I think it makes it feel more cinematic because everything's voice acted. I think I just sort of accepted and knew that it wasn't going to be Harrison Ford. So I was like, okay, it is what it is. Yeah, it'd be nice to have Indy's voice in there, but I understand that that's not exactly a simple thing to get done. So it's fine.
Yeah, at the time of Fate of Atlantis, they did LucasArts did talk to Harrison Ford, and they almost convinced him to do it.
Yeah,
but he couldn't because he was making movies or doing things that actually pay real money compared to doing a voice of a game at that point.
He was probably doing like prepping for like Air Force One or something like that.
Oh, like sure. I mean, like Air Force One or.
Which is totally fine because.
Absolutely.
Let's make Air Force One, you know?
That works. All the Air Force. Yeah. Maybe you'll see Air Force Two before too long. Who knows?
Right. Everything else seems to be coming back. So why not that?
Jeez. But yeah, I mean, so with this game, you have the Russians as the bad guy. I do like that you have as a mechanic, you have the trading post in between levels where you can stock up on ammo and stuff, and that's good. And yet, combat is never great in these Indiana Jones games.
Yeah.
It's a little bit, like, you get used to the jumping with the whip and opening the doors and running away from the spikes and all those, and that's fine. But there's something with, whether it's the hand-to-hand or fighting with the whip, where either it looks silly or you have to get the aim just right, or the sound effect for the pistol is not what you're expecting.
I thought it was kind of funny how like even just the way the game starts, I assumed, because like the only enemy is really in that first level are snakes, and there's like two or three of them or something like that, right? Yeah. And I was like, oh, I'm gonna take out the whip and I'm gonna whip the snake. Nope, Indy has to shoot the snake. So it's like, they like really want to make sure that they tell you that he hates snakes. Like they really want to make sure that that is part of his personality in this game as well. So, the combat, I thought the shooting was, you know, the firing and stuff was mostly okay. You kind of walk into a certain bubble around enemies and he kind of auto aims and stuff. And it's tough to kind of know exactly where you need to go or how you need to do it, 'cause it kind of does it for you. There's a bit of a first person view, but I almost never use that throughout the game. 'Cause that's also kind of awkward. And yeah, it's awkward, I think, is mostly it feels very clunky for sure. And like you said earlier, of its time. But yeah, I agree. It's
Looks like here it might be contributing to the rarity of the game is it only came out in North America for Nintendo 64.
Oh, okay.
So there that would go. Also increase the rarity right there. And they were supposed to do it in Europe, and the PAL version was just taking too long. It certainly came out on PC first. And when it came out on Nintendo 64, I recall in interviews, the designer Hal Barwood preferred the Nintendo 64 version. He felt like it was better with the N64 controller. I think they improved some of the sampling on the sound effects and some of the wall textures.
Yeah.
So that does say something that development started in March 99, but it didn't come out until, looks like October 2000. You know, they spent quite a bit of time on it, so.
Yeah. It was in the fall and winter of 2000, depending on where you were, maybe, but that sounds pretty quick to me. So it's like, especially compared to nowadays, but yeah, it's, I think the whole like wall texture thing and stuff, I think for the most part, it looks pretty good. Some of the levels feel a little bit larger than I would have expected. It's a 3D action game, so I guess you're going to get that.
It does have a nice scope to it, and you go to these new locations and it feels like, oh, this is a place I need to explore. I want to see what's over there. It has that Zelda feeling, which is important.
Yeah.
It's not a bunch of hallways and doors.
Yeah, because like you go out into the desert or you're in, I don't know if it's like a forest and it's like it's winter and snowing and stuff like that. And it feels very, that is part of the reason why I think it still feels very Indiana Jones is because in most of the movies, or if not all of them, he's going to multiple places and they're going for different reasons to look for different things and talk to certain people to get more information and meeting up with this person and that person. Oh, this person's actually a bad guy instead of someone who's on your side. And all those little things that happened felt very, very indie. And I think putting that in areas that still felt somewhat expansive, I would say, like some, like you said, you can go around and explore this corner and you'll, I don't know, you'll probably find like a little treasure or something like that. And those treasures, it's funny because I had no idea what they did most of the time when I found them. I was like, what is this? I don't know what this thing is. He goes, ooh, look what I found. And then you have that little trading post thing that you mentioned earlier where you just exchange it for health and ammo and things like that. And I think that's kind of interesting. And it carries over through to your levels, your items and everything. But adding to the clunkiness is also like switching between your items, I think. And switching between your weapons and all that. And did you have like a certain habit or certain way of switching through weapons? Because you could pause the game and flip through the little menu to get to your gun or your whip or your fists or whatever. Or you can press, I can't remember what key it was because I switched over to the controller, but you can press it and he'll sort of cycle through his stuff. But it takes forever just to switch up all his items.
Yeah, I tried to do it while I was playing the game and kept on forgetting the button or got distracted by something. So I just did it through the menu every time. Okay. Even though you go to the menu and it takes you out of the game and it sort of pauses it. I kind of, in a way, liked it because I don't play as much action games as I used to. And it's like, oh, I can switch my weapons without being attacked.
Right. Yeah, that makes. Yeah. No, I mean, it gives you a little bit of like a small breather, I guess, mm-hmm. in a way. Right. So that's true. And eventually you get like different weapons and stuff, too. It's not just like your pistol and just your whip and everything. So there's also I found, you know, maybe sometimes it was a little bit hard to figure out what to do. But I thought the puzzle element of it, the very Indiana Jones. Hey, what do I do in this room to, you know, bring that brick wall down or to get into that part of the cave or whatever. I liked those. I enjoyed sort of going around to those different corners, like you mentioned, and sort of finding that one piece or jumping over that one ledge to kind of go around the corner to figure out what I needed. Those parts to me were my favorite. I don't know if you had the same feeling.
I agree. I think those parts were good. Sometimes it took me a bit of time to figure out where I could climb and where I couldn't.
Yeah.
That was a little bit tricky, but you're right. I mean, but you know, the music plays and stuff changes in the room and you kind of get excited like, okay, now I can get to this part I want to go to. And I don't know with the combat, what they would have done because you didn't really have quick time events back then.
Right.
And I'm trying to think of, they did a few other Indiana Jones games after this one. What it was Staff of Kings and.
Oh yeah. I remember that one.
What was the other Emperor's Tomb or something like that. And those had a little bit better systems, but they also tried to make the physics of it too realistic sometimes.
Right. So I will say the physics in this, when talking about like controlling him and doing these puzzles and stuff, every once in a while you have to make a certain jump. And I'm like, there's no way this is where I'm supposed to go. And he just fucking launches.
Right.
I was like, and it happens in the first stage as well. But like, once you realize that, I can say like, oh, that wasn't just a fluke. Like, no, all of us in some areas, like you said, you take the momentum to kind of get that jump. And then he just like, and sure, he grabs on with his arms and he's like holding onto the ledge and, you know, sort of very cinematic and very movie and very Indiana Jones kind of thing. But I couldn't believe sometimes just the legs on this guy and how far he could jump sometimes. It was hilarious. I laughed every single time. I was like, whoa, he just jumped across a whole chasm. Like that's crazy.
He's jumping across chasms, whole canyons.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I would have those problems too with the, it's not Indiana Jones exactly, but the Uncharted games.
Yep.
Where on like PlayStation 3 and stuff where you're making I was stuck on like maybe level 4 or something. You're trying to get inside the first underground temple area And I'm like, there's no way he can make that jump. So like an idiot, I'm trying to like jump in the corner for 30 minutes and think, you know, the most complex thing. And then I go on YouTube and see a video. It's like, nope, you can run and make this leap that would, you know, every other, you know, and because at the time, I think the graphics were so realistic, I assumed, oh, he jumps like a real human. And it's like, well, no, it's still a video game.
He's an extension of Indiana Jones. I mean,
yes.
Maybe if you played enough of this game before, you would have known that Nathan Drake is basically a robot, and he can
right. He's like the $5 million man or whatever. Yeah, it's just doing those huge jumps. You're right. I think once you figure it out and it starts clicking, you get used to what puzzles mean in this game and what the jumping is in this game, what the It does keep you moving between different locations, and towards the end, as you're putting together the pieces of the artifact, I think that's a nice momentum to keep the plot going.
Yes, I do like that. Yeah, because you kind of get, like, in that, again, in the first stage early, and pretty early on, you get a couple of, like, pieces that you need that you kind of have for the rest of the game and stuff, and those pieces, you kind of figure out what do they do. We kind of know generally where we're going. Or like what the end goal kind of might be, that like you get hints here and there. And yeah, those things that you collect, the main items, are it's rewarding. It feels rewarding enough, even if like the journey there, because of the controls and some of the combat and stuff isn't always great. I think how they push the story forward with what you're collecting and what you're trying to find and who you're trying to track down and things, I think it kept me going, even though I wasn't having the easiest time controlling it. I will say that, you know, you were saying that the one of the creators of the game was saying that the 64 version that he preferred. I will say I did find my groove better with the controller, which I started playing, I think, in the third stage, easier than when I was using the keyboard. So that may have helped you a little bit, but it's not like he moved really smoothly or anything. He still moved the same way. So that part was still the same.
Yeah. And you said you had played the Game Boy Color version, I think.
I played it very briefly because I knew somebody that had a version. And all I remember of it, and I've looked up a couple screenshots, it's kind of how I remember it, where it's sort of a little bit top down and you're kind of jumping over things. And how it felt and how the game was, I honestly couldn't tell you. I just remember having some mild experience with it. So honestly, I wouldn't be surprised if that, I wouldn't say this game is bad. I wouldn't say this N64 Infernal Machine is a bad game, but I wouldn't be surprised if playing the Game Boy Color version would feel more natural based on just platforming, right? Because platforming in games like this at this time, we're not perfected yet by any means. And this game, I think, shows that a little bit. So I don't know.
Definitely. And you have, you know, these sort of 3D action games were still fairly new at the time. There wasn't a whole lot of them out. They still were trying to figure out what it was. How did the camera work? How did, you know, how do you do the level design? And with that Game Boy Color version, there had been, you know, games with that kind of top-down perspective forever. I mean, even I think the first video game Indiana Jones I ever played was a Temple of Doom in the arcade, where it's that same kind of perspective where you're going on the cart and rescuing the little kids, and you're just in the temple the whole time going through these little mazes. So that wouldn't surprise me with the Game Boy Color one. Now I want to play it, you know, perhaps be more accessible. And it's that this game, again, is on N64 on a cartridge, I think is really impressive. You didn't see a lot of games with this fidelity. There was some like first person stuff like Turok, but that was a bit different. That was more straight up action. But I think unless you're doing, I don't know, Quest 64 or Zelda really is the gold standard.
Yeah, I would say recently, as of this recording anyway, played through Jet Force Gemini again, and that game is pretty big and expansive. I think there's a decent amount going on, but I would say that the difference with the indie game is that it's not the same game, obviously, but there's something, if it still feels different being in these environments, like they still feel bigger, even though some of them aren't, than a game compared to GeForce Gemini, which sometimes just has open space and you're just going through that open space to get the one little small area or another. And it's just, it's laid out differently and it still feels big, but something about this one still made you feel like you were going through this grand adventure, even if it was a little clunky here and there.
Yeah. And it's nice they didn't, because this was on a Nintendo system, they didn't like make it too cutesy. You didn't have you didn't have to collect 500 snakes or statues in every level. You, like you said, it did have the voice acting, which was pretty unusual in a cartridge.
Yep.
To have that, that must have taken up a lot of, I just can't imagine the how to fit all that in a tiny cartridge.
I don't understand how they did this kind of, and this wasn't a game that needed the expansion pack or anything, which is insane, because usually that would be a sign of like, oh, there's extra stuff. Like if it did, I actually think maybe they could have, maybe things, I don't know if it would have changed the game at all, but maybe. But yeah, I think it was a feat to do what they did onto this cartridge. I think that is definitely something to pay attention to for sure. This is one of those games. Every once in a while you come across them. I think this should be added to the list. And I had no idea. I thought it was just going to be some average, whatever thing, but it's pretty big. It's not short either. You know, it's not like you're playing this thing for 3 hours and you're done. Like you're going on a trek in this game. And it takes some time. So, hopefully, did you enjoy it overall? Did you feel like it was, you know, despite its flaws, I guess?
I'd put it kind of right down the middle. You said it was okay, and I think that's absolutely fair. I think, I don't know if you rate games on this show or not, but if you were saying out of five, with five being the highest, I might say like 3 out of 5.
Sure. Is
fair for this title. It's a meaty adventure. It's tough to track down, but I mean, on the other hand, that you can get it on PC so easy is nice. And I do love the cover artwork that's by Drew Struzan, who did the posters for the movies and everything. It captures that Harrison Ford likeness, even though if in the game it doesn't really look like Harrison Ford all that much.
Yeah,
but it captures that sense of, you know, going on an adventure. And because some of these covers back then, they would be like screenshots of the game or maybe just models of stuff from the game that blown up that big don't look that great. Like they're meant to be played on an older TV, CRT TV with the, and I guess I have to ask you, cause you had the Nintendo 64 growing up. How did you have it plugged into the TV? What cables did you use? Was it?
Oh, just whatever basic cables would come with it.
Red, yellow, and white.
Yeah, we never did anything different, because I don't think we would have known to do anything different. And I don't think we'd have, honestly, I don't think I had a TV at that time that would be able to do anything different. So yeah, it was just a standard. Yeah.
Yeah, I think for me with the Nintendo and Super Nintendo, the TV I had was so crappy. It was like a RCA or something. Mm-hmm. I had the Nintendo and Super Nintendo with the RF splitter.
Yes, I had that for the Super Nintendo. I absolutely had that.
So a very snowy screen with a lot of distortion. And
very, talk about an awkward way to have to plug in and unplug and whatever, you know, your console, if you're moving it or whatever. It was.
Yeah.
It
and
was,
then if you bump the TV, the thing falls out the side. That is one thing with all the modern HDMI, and I say modern, but they've been around for a while, but like the HDMI and the USB, the USB plugins are just so easy to plug in and out and they don't fall out the, fall off the edge. Like, oh, the Dolby Digital plug or that got some of those.
Yes. Things. Yeah. Yeah. Well, and God forbid, you know, whether it was component cables or what we had for the Super Nintendo and stuff, God forbid you were a little too far away from the TV and you did something either exciting or frustrating and you pulled the controller. Well, now everything is all over the place and everything's unplugged and on the floor. And, you know, I know for a fact that I did that for sure with the Super Nintendo. There's no way I didn't, because I was even younger and it still works. I got it in the other room beside me. It's a original controller. Aside from what connects to the TV now, everything, the power cable's original, it's all original and all still works. But that thing definitely took a couple falls off the off the table, I would say, and must have.
Well, and we were all playing the games with the crappy built-in TV speakers and that were all mono.
Yes. Yes. Like, yes.
I think there's so many little, even the built-in speakers are a lot better now, but even with like a cheap sound bar or something, you still get much, much better sound.
Yeah. And even in games like this, like, sure, we played the PC versions, but I've you know, hooked up headphones to the 64 when I've played it through my PC screen and things like that. And you notice that, like, oh, the sound is actually decent on this. At the time, it was never anything I paid too much attention to, but you plug it in properly and you get things running and you go, oh, stereo sound on these even 25-year-old games is still pretty cool. I still really enjoy it. And it, like you just said, it's never anything we would have experienced at the time, because I don't even think I owned headphones until I was, you know, 15 years old or something. You know, I just didn't. So
exactly.
Yeah. So Indiana Jones and the Infernal Machine, we went on an adventure with Indy. We tackled the gods and we saved the day and all this kind of stuff. But overall, I think it's sort of like a middle ground type of game. I would say give it a shot, but I don't think it's one of those must plays. And that's okay. Not everything's going to be. At least it wasn't a complete failure. I have such a soft spot for Indiana Jones. I'm happy that at least I was able to experience more with Indy, even if it's not a movie. So that's kind of where I stand. I don't know about you.
I think that's fair. Yeah. If you like Indiana Jones, I think you'll like this game a little bit more.
Yeah.
It's not going to work miracles. On the other hand, you know, if you're looking for something that, you know, kind of a bigger action adventure game that is maybe a little bit more mature than some other stuff on the system, where it's not animals with big eyeballs that go doot 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 when they talk. You know, Indiana Jones, Infernal Machine, there's nothing quite like it on the Nintendo 64. I think that makes it pretty unique. If you happen to find it for a good price, get it, because I think it'll only... It's probably a game that keeps its value, considering A, it's Indiana Jones, and B, there wasn't that many copies made of it.
Yeah. Yeah. So good luck if you are trying to find it, but if you do, hang on to it and take care of it, I think, because I think you're right. I think it's going to be one of those things that you can treasure, especially if you're an indie fan. Put it up, you know, on the shelf beside your movies and stuff. I think that would be really cool to sort of have something like that. But there's versions out there. We played the PC versions. It's the best we can get, but it was still pretty fun to be able to do so. So, all right, Matt, I'll let you go. But before that, let's talk a little bit about where everyone can find your awesome stuff online.
Yeah, so my podcast, as you mentioned, is also part of the Tokyo Beat Podcast Network. It's called SequelCast 2 and Friends. We've been going since 2009, which is hard to believe. We've been looking at
crazy
movies.
Man. It is so cool.
Thanks. We've been looking at movies in a franchise, one film at a time. So. And in some of these franchises, we split up. I mean, listen, if we did like Godzilla or James Bond, I'd kill myself. I would not want to do 30 episodes of that in a row. But as of this recording, depending on when this comes out, we should be doing some of the earlier Mission Impossible movies.
Nice. Nice.
Every so often, we do interviews, and we're going to be interviewing Gary K. Wolfe, who wrote the original novel that Who Framed Roger Rabbit was based off of.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And he's done like four or five books since then. I think he's working on a new one, including the most recent one. I forget the name of it, but it's like Jessica Rabbit. It's a prequel, but it takes place in present day, uses some time bending stuff. And okay. Jessica Rabbit's character is a human and lives with her family in a trailer park and joins a spy organization. And it's the books are fun and wacky and very different from the movie. Okay. And yet each book stands alone. So you don't have to read the books in order to make sense, but they have titles like, I don't think the original is Who Framed Roger Rabbit. I forget, but some of the other ones was like Who Whacked Roger Rabbit, Who Plugged Roger Rabbit. And because of this sweetheart deal the author got with Disney way back then, he's able to use the official likeness of Roger Rabbit and Jessica Rabbit on his books without having to pay for the rights every time.
Yes.
So that's pretty unusual. And then the books usually on the cover have like a photo of him dressed as the detective and the cartoon drawings of the other characters around him. So
nice.
But yeah, so I'm looking forward to interviewing Kim. I'm about to as we were talking offline, I'm going on a cruise to Alaska and Canada. So I have some downtime to read some of his books on my Kindle before the interview. So looking forward to that.
Awesome.
And that's at sequelcast2.com. What else? I also have written some books. You can get those on Amazon.com. MATWBT.com is the website. I wrote the first English language book on Uwe Boll.
Oh,
so cool. It's just on his video game movies. I'm working on books on the other ones.
Nice.
And I have a book coming out in a year or two about Star Trek video games. So I got to interview people for that, and I didn't cover every single game, but it was about, ended up being like 43 or 42 books or games. And
just 40 something. No,
just 40 something. Yeah, well, and they've been making them for so long, and a lot of them are bootlegs, and there's so many different types. I think that's part of what attracted me to it. And
sure.
I guess to leave off on that note, my wife and I were lucky enough to do a Star Trek cruise back in February where they had actors and stuff on, and they had the Next Generation people up on there. And I said, well, a lot of you guys did the voices on the video games back in the day. Was that a good experience? And it got complete silence in response. And then
really?
Marina Sirtis, who plays Deanna Troi, mimed like she was yawning. And I said, okay, Marina, what do you think? And then she's like, I thought it was really boring. I think anyone that plays video games doesn't have a life unless they play Tetris on Game Boy. She proceeded to get booed by an audience of over 200.
Oh my God.
I have the audio. I don't know what to do with the audio, but
it happened.
It happened. I made sure to record whenever I ask a question in a public venue.
That's amazing.
So I think, that book should come out, I think probably in 2024, 2025, something like that.
Okay,
so,
sweet.
So look forward to that. I didn't speak to any Indiana Jones related people for that, but I guess, what else with Indiana Jones? I'm just rambling here. So I used to live in Atlanta, Georgia, and Dragon Con is the big convention down there. And okay. I got to see John Rhys-Davies speak live.
Ooh.
Who was Sala. And at least when he's on stage and the microphone's in front of him, he uses the same voice he does for Sala, which is pretty intense in person. This big, deep, booming voice. And I think at the time he didn't have much to promote, but he mentioned with Indiana Jones, with Raiders of the Lost Ark, they made the movie very cheaply and very quickly, and a lot of what's in the movie is bad takes. And he said with Last Crusade, it seemed like Spielberg had already directed the movie in his head beforehand and seemed less focused. Which I think is interesting, because Last Crusade, I would say, is one of the better ones, but at the same time, people argue it's sort of a remake of Raiders of the Lost Ark in some respect.
I enjoy it because it's the funniest. That's why.
Yeah. Well, and Sean Connery makes such a
is incredible
huge difference.
It's incredible. Yeah, for sure. That's amazing.
Well, great. Well, no, thanks for having me on here. This was fun. I hope I could help you out with Indiana Jones and the Infernal Machine.
I'm really happy that we were able to have a chance to play it, and we'll keep an eye on your stuff online. Thanks for joining, man. Thank you once again for joining me on this adventure of Remember 64 and with Indiana Jones and Matt from the Sequel Cast. I just wanted to quickly plug the fact that patreon.com/remember64show is always there for you to help us grow the show, as little as $1 a month. Get things early, help us tailor what we're going to do next as far as what games we're going to play, and we're going to have some fun early content as well, like video content, video episodes, and some new stuff. Patreon's expanding, as I mentioned earlier in the podcast. They're going to have some free content up there as well for everybody. And if you do sign up now, and with limited availability at the moment at least, a free holographic Remember 64 sticker that will be in the mail to you if you become a patron. Other than that, toss a rating on your podcast app of choice. Would always appreciate that. Or you can always email us, remember64show@gmail.com. Let us know how things are going, how you want to see the show potentially evolve. We do have some pretty fun ideas coming up. In 2024, we're going to be doing a decent amount of episodes that are going to be different kinds of games. Yes, N64 related, but unreleased games.
We're going to do games that are N64-like, but are released more recently. There's a lot of fun stuff out there, talking to developers, covering games that aren't just on the N64 library. So lots of fun, interesting, and different stuff coming up as well to get some variety on your podcast feed. But that's all from us this time and from myself here on the podcast. Thank you so much once again for listening. We'll catch you next time on Remember 64.